Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CPRMetro.org. Well, we have another amazing show for you today. And as always, whatever space, whatever time, whatever place you're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox in, we are going to occupy the truth and we're going to occupy accountability for the people who are lying to us. My guests today are Mickey Z. He's going to talk about his new book, Occupy This Book, and Gloria LaRiva, who is an activist who will be talking about what's really going on in Venezuela. News that you won't hear about on the corporate media. As a matter of fact, we're going to dispel the lies of the corporate media. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Mickey Z. Our first guest on the soapbox today is Mickey Z. Mickey's born and raised in Astoria, Queens. Mickey Z is probably the only person on the planet to have appeared in both a political book with Noam Chomsky and a karate flick with Billy Blanks. Armed with a high school diploma, Mickey is the author of 12 books and has spoken and lectured in venues ranging from MIT to ABC No Rio and from Yale University to Occupy Free University. Mickey Z, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on. So I'm having you on because you wrote the book, Occupy This Book, and I was honored and thrilled that you asked me to write the foreword to it. But before we talk about your book, tell my listeners about yourself, anything you want to say, your background, how you got into activism, or whatever. You know, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, we have a wide variety of people on, and we like to give as many people as we can a chance to tell their stories.
Well, I really appreciate that. The short version, I guess, is New York City, born and raised. I kind of always identified as someone that would be anti-authority, but after high school, I chose to embark on a path of self-education, and as I became more aware of the information and the authors that I hadn't been introduced to via mainstream school and so on, I became more radicalized, and that was sort of the path that led me to activism, led me to becoming a vegan. I was radical before I was vegan. I saw it as a revolutionary choice, and embark on a lifestyle of activism and trying to really counter the corporate paradigm, in the sense that what we hear 24 hours a day, I just do my best to present information and ideas that would sort of fill in the gaps and then trust people to make up their minds from there. And that's kind of led me in the direction I'm in now and to be right here on the phone, in this interview with you.
So when you graduated from high school, what was going on in the world and in the U.S. that had you suspicious? And not very many high school young people would choose that direction at that time.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it was at the dawn of the Reagan era, and a time where a lot was seemed to be going on that wasn't properly explained. And just, it's sort of an interesting concept. Once you open your mind to the possibility of learning outside of the mainstream system, you encounter people who've chosen similar paths and turn you on to authors and books and ideas. And some of the early works that I read was from the situationists in France and Guy Debord, in an abstract sense, but more practically, books by Chomsky, Zinn, and so on. Once I read people's history, the gaps began to be filled in and the paths laid out before me. So I found the patterns, which we see right till this very minute, these patterns repeat themselves over and over in terms of how we're programmed through propaganda and what actions are taken, which we can then justify. And I just promised myself that I would always question and challenge what I was being told as acceptable or conventional or normal, and I never looked back and regretted it.
you know, even though I, you know, was not an activist until my son was killed, really, I mean, I think a lot of us who care about our community, and I was a youth minister, so I cared about, I was an advocate for young people, the voiceless, you know, and even though I wasn't an activist, I grew up during the height of the Vietnam, you know, horror. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't an activist, but I was always skeptical of the government and anything, you know, propaganda, the media. You know, I never quite trusted it, even though I wasn't as advanced as you were.
Well, I don't want to take credit for being too advanced, because I say that with all humility and honesty, because I have the honor and the privilege now of being around on a regular basis activists that are of traditional high school and college age that are just so evolved, so knowledgeable, so savvy, so sharp, that I look at them and say, why wasn't I on this level at that age? But, you know, it was a different time period. The access to information has changed. The speed with which we can get the information has changed. So, I'm glad I grew up when I did, because I enjoy having my foot in that life too, pre-internet and pre-cell phone world. But I look with a little bit of envy at people at the younger generation now, at how quickly they can accumulate information, and if they're in circles that encourage independent thought, they can begin just sharing such valuable perspectives. So I think I just, like I said, I was always a bit of a anti-authority, and I liked counterculture, writers, music, and those individuals and groups do kind of inspire you to question if you pay attention to the lyrics or what they're writing. And I think it was more of an abstract sense. And then if I would ever use the word advanced, it would be later on when I began to marshal the evidence that sort of made my instincts make sense. And then once I had the evidence, I said, I just want to dedicate myself to sharing this. Like, it seemed like there's so much that we need to know before we can make an informed opinion. So if I could play a role in sharing that evidence, I would enjoy it. It would be a labor of love, and I think it would also be of some value.
Well, and you were involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement. What was that like to be so, you know, immersed in it?
It was speaking personally, it was a much needed shot in the arm, so to speak, because after 2008, when so many of my leftist comrades fell for the hope and change,
right.
I was pretty cynical and depressed in the sense that, like, wow, what's it going to take for people to question this entire system? And so the first time I walked into Zuccotti Park, the first sign I saw that was laying on the ground, it said, industrial civilization is murdering the earth. And I was like, well, you can't get any more holistic big picture than that.
Uh-huh.
And I began walking around and meeting people who literally were radicalized on September 17th, 2011. And I felt an energy I hadn't felt in a long, long time. And so from a personal viewpoint, it was so crucial in re-inspiring me as to continuing on this mission. In terms of value, you know, the individuals that made up Occupy Wall Street have scattered in many different directions, but made an impact and made Occupy as a word sort of a global brand as to standing up to authority. So I think it was a really powerful moment overall globally. But it was also a sobering example of the power of corporate propaganda and state repression, that when they feel threatened at all, how quickly they can step in and really take steps to keep the mainstream from embracing this narrative.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the thing is, you know, for me, to witness how violent the system was against some of the Occupy, you know, demonstrations or encampments was, you know, excuse me, I don't know what happened to my voice. You know, I just don't understand why more Americans weren't up in arms about that. It just seems like, I even see this on the left, the so-called left, as I like to call the left, is that if we want to celebrate freedom of speech, but only if it agrees with us. But it seems like every person in this country should have been up in arms against the violent suppression of freedom of speech and freedom to peaceably assemble.
I completely agree. There should always be room for someone to say, you know what, I read the Occupy Wall Street Declaration pamphlet, and I don't fully agree with X, Y, or Z. That's healthy debate. But why people who pride themselves as living in the so-called land of the free can look the other way when it's right there on the evening news, the repression, the violent repression. And my own personal experience, just witnessing the NYPD just basically making up new rules every single time you encounter them.
Right.
I mean, just walking around trying to take photos at demos, you had to be so vigilant to not put your foot here, there, a place where you'd immediately be tossed down and arrested because you broke this arbitrary rule that they made up right there 15 minutes earlier. Right. And when you have the mass arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge, of course, the infamous pepper spray, and then the shooting, the canister in Occupy Oakland, you would think that to some degree this would mobilize more people. But I do like to believe that it did create an awareness that perhaps wasn't there before. And I still talk to people that will express shock at the response, the violent response, but I guess that's the power of corporate propaganda, that people won't either verbalize it or even go further and get involved because we're so heavily conditioned not to make those choices.
Well, I want to talk about your book titled Occupy This Book, but I just want you to comment on this thing I saw. I have a wide range of, social media contacts, from right-wing libertarians to, communists, anarchists, whatever. And one of my Facebook friends said that Bloomberg was the most liberal mayor New York has ever had.
I guess, my first question would be to that person is, could you define liberal? Because
exactly.
Maybe it's his unique definition of the word liberal, but as someone who lived here through three terms, which just saying those words three terms because he bent all the rules to get the third term,
right,
defies the term liberal. The freedom he gave the NYPD and stop and frisk, and not just Occupy, because let me quickly say that the most important point is that the communities of color in New York City have faced that repression forever. So when a bunch of predominantly white activists face it isn't like I'm presenting this as something new. It was new in the sense that they were doing it on camera to white people. Like, that was new-ish. But in this city, the communities of color live in 24/7 fear of the gang in blue, and Bloomberg did nothing to change that. He was the mayor of the affluent. He publicly said the NYPD was his private army, and he ruled it as such. And there were times that we would do demonstrations at his townhouse up on East 79th Street. They would literally shut the entire block, and the only people who could get in were the wealthy people who lived on that block, randomly just shutting down a public street because we couldn't even get within a block of where he lived, whether he was home or not. So I could probably go on for the rest of the interview giving examples of how he wouldn't define any rational definition of liberal. But what happens, and you know this as well as anyone, when you're Obama following George W. Bush or you're Bloomberg following Giuliani, like a cartoon character of the right, you almost by proxy become viewed as being more articulate or more moderate or more liberal because you're not as much a cartoon character as your predecessor. So that enables you to use the same exact tactics with a little smile on your face and have the liberals lined up behind you and say, see, this is democracy. So Bloomberg on a smaller scale following Giuliani was like Obama following W.
Well, yeah, exactly. Good point. And we had, what are you talking about, Giuliani? He's America's mayor. What are you talking about? He led the, you know, he led the fight against those terrorists that invaded the United States.
I don't know how we ever would have won that war without him, honestly.
Exactly.
<You're right.
laughs> But anyway, and then I look at all the violent suppression of Occupy Wall Street, and they were Democrat mayors that were doing it. And, you know, even the one that I went to the most, Occupy Sacramento, you know, we had wasn't violent suppression, but it was just a very concentrated suppression of our freedom of speech and freedom to peaceably assemble. And he's a Democratic mayor who's more concerned about building a basketball arena than, you know, housing homeless people, et cetera. So, Mickey, tell my listeners about your book, Occupy This Book.
Okay, thank you. The title is a play off Abby Hoffman's classic book, Steal This Book. And when I use the term Occupy, as I mentioned earlier, I'm sort of using it as a general word, brand, if you will, of activism. It's not specifically about the individuals that made up Occupy Wall Street in New York. But the essence of the book is the discussion of activism, the need for activism, my own personal experiences, and trying to inspire people to embrace this lifestyle. I would say the initial purpose of the book is to instill a sense of urgency that we are, if we haven't passed the point of no return, it is rapidly approaching. And simultaneously, that would be safe for folks who haven't yet stepped up to do activism. And for those who are involved, I also really, really, on a parallel level, try to inspire a greater sense of solidarity and a commitment to outreach, to grow the movement. Because I think what the hopes that we could have would be if we recognize how urgent situations are from the small levels all the way up to global ecocide, we will respond accordingly. But we can't sit around waiting for the perfect activist movement or someone to agree with us 100% before we can move forward. We need to find ways to create solidarity, to commit to outreach, to bring more people in, and to create change really as soon as possible. And so this is my own little contribution to this global struggle, and based on personal experience and just some general thoughts in the name of inspiring and provoking thought and action.
Well, what are some of your concrete suggestions?
Well, the book contains a fair amount of non-concrete suggestions, but one of the things that I ask people to consider is what's going on in terms of the ecosystem.
Right.
And recognizing that if we are passionate about the struggle for, say, single-payer healthcare, it'd be wonderful if that passed. But the point would be moot if we don't have a functioning ecosystem. So I don't know if you would define this as concrete, but I'm encouraging people to simultaneously occupy a big picture and small picture perspective where you can follow your heart where your passion is. You want to get a homeless shelter, you want to stop and frisk, you want to get single payer, you want the corporations to pay more taxes. These are all worthwhile goals. But we need to also be looking at the big picture in terms of protecting the only ecosystem we have. So that would be like an initial concept there. I also, you know, as someone that's very proudly involved in the vegan and animal rights movements, I do try to inspire people to broaden their perspective to a sense of collective liberation. That if their concept of equality and justice and liberation only includes one species, I would have to say that that's not equality, justice, or liberation. We need to have that big picture of all earthlings, including the ecosystem, and to question all our personal choices in terms of what they mean as part of this revolutionary movement. And I think that if people empower themselves sometimes with these smaller personal choices, they'll find that it's able to progress from there, and it enables them to find like-minded kindred spirits who've made similar choices. And as you know, collective efforts is what's going to get the work done. It's not going to be individuals, but we need to find people who are willing to work with us.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, before people just, some people think that I was just like some kind of, you know, harpy screaming at George Bush for killing my son. But really, before I even came to that place, I had to recognize and deal with my own part in my son's death. So, if people don't think that's hard, you know,
yeah,
they can look at their choices and how it is. It's, you know, then after that, I just couldn't be unauthentic in anything that I do. So, you know, sometimes I am. We're not always perfect, but then you deal with it and learn from it and then move on, because the only way you can do is go forward. But just talking about veganism and how that is affecting, how people's choices affect the environment. Here in California, we're in a deep drought. And I just read a story that down south, that big ag, they're like taking millions of gallons of water to irrigate alfalfa to send to China to feed cattle.
Well, that doesn't make sense to you? You don't see the logic?
No, I do not.
Well, what you bring up highlights a really powerful point, because very, very often when I encounter, in particular, people on the left who have already made many radical choices, and I talk about, and I used to say the word vegan, one of the first responses hurled at me is, hey, that's your personal choice. You want to eat what you want. Don't tell me what to eat.
Right.
And I say it's not a personal choice if it's consuming and destroying one-third of the planet's land surface. It's not a personal choice if it's the number one source of human-created greenhouse gases. It's not a personal choice if it's diverting water, as you just said, from other sources so we can fatten up genetically modified animals, have them shipped back and then sold to us as quote unquote food. And whenever I do talk, teachings, etc. on food justice issues, I connect it to the global animal agribusiness. I connect it to the environment. I connect it to Monsanto and other, DuPont and other companies that genetically modify foods. This is all, you know, intricately interwoven, and the choices that we make weigh heavily on what is allowed to happen globally. So if we want, and Angela Davis, who is a vegan, has said this, that being a vegan is part of a revolutionary perspective. If we want to have a radical and revolutionary perspective on the world, why not live it 24 hours a day? And as you say, the goal isn't perfection. There's no such thing as perfection. It's all process. And if we embrace the process and move forward, what I found as I was radical in a foreign policy, political science sense, then I embraced veganism, then that compassion that's an inherent part of veganism opened my eyes to broadening my perspective to challenging all hierarchies. So when I do an event, for example, I always make sure the venue is wheelchair accessible, because I have many, many comrades in the disability rights movement. So why it would be ableist of me to ignore their needs. And as we talked earlier, it would be ageist to assume that someone that's in high school doesn't know what they're talking about. And so I've learned to be so much more aware, because I'm born a white middle-class male in New York City, so I basically hit the privilege jackpot. So I need to check myself all the time. And I found that being in the vegan animal rights movement was a wonderful first step in that direction, in terms of thinking outside of your own needs. And I embrace it as a process. I don't pretend for a second that I always get it right, but I can do my best every day to have the best intentions. And so I encourage people to look at these choices in that holistic way. It isn't just a personal choice. The language you use, the choices you make, the food you eat, the clothes you wear, where you shop or not shop, play a role, not just economically, but on your comrades, on the people around you, because you start discussing your choices and explaining why you try not to buy something that's made in a sweatshop. And that's a powerful, useful discussion. So that's kind of the general vibe. I've been writing about this for years, and when Sullivan Street Press approached me and said, do you want to do a book on activism? I was like, oh, I'm kind of going in demos all the time and doing this. And they said, well, you know, you're kind of writing it already in articles and all.
Right.
And that's when it made sense to me to kind of put this together into one vision of saying, hey, if you're an activist, get more active, embrace more solidarity, go more holistic. If you haven't gotten out there, hey, let's recognize the urgency that we really, really need you. We are running out of time.
Well, yes, good point, Mickey. And I just like, whenever I post anything about being a vegan or veganism, or whenever I post anything about not owning a car, I just get like, it's when I get attacked the most on Facebook. To me, it's just like, how can, you know, it's one thing to own a car and drive a car. It's one thing to be a flesh eater. But to me, it's like, how can you defend that?
I don't believe you can. I agree with you.
And just about
people,
smoking, too. I post something about smoking and about how not only is it bad for you, it's bad for the people that surround you. It's poisonous for the earth, the toxins that the cigarette companies know that they put in it, how they are global rapers and murderers, and people like jump all over my stuff about that too.
Yeah, they get, you know, so I guess it's sort of a libertarian type of perspective of like personal choices, and how could it be a personal choice to smoke, for example, like you said, if it's impacting everyone? That defies the concept of a personal choice. You know, personal choice is whether I live in New York City and want to root for the Yankees or Mets. That's a personal choice. But if I'm saying I'm going to openly, I know all this information, but I'm still going to eat food that I know is contributing towards the death of our ecosystem, tell the animals that it's a personal choice. I mean, every single time an animal is killed for what we call food, and then we call it a personal choice, you know, it's like someone calling Bloomberg a liberal. It's like, I'd have to ask you, what do you mean by personal then? If you had a sentient being killed for you, how does the word personal even enter into that? That animal didn't have a choice. It wanted to live. I think we could all say that. It wanted to live. You said, no, I need to eat bacon. So it's an ongoing battle, and I find that some of the most resistance I get is from folks who are already on the left and are embracing other struggles for justice, but have this glaring contradiction where they refuse to look at some of their personal choices. And so I found more recently that when I do more outreach at demonstrations and at talks and so on to what we would call the general public or the mainstream, they're strangely not biased by the theories and concepts and paradigms of the left, and seem to be more open-minded. Like if someone hears about the movie Blackfish and says, wow, it's a shame that those orcas are kept in captivity,
right,
and now you use that opening to talk about factory farms or puppy mills or vivisection labs, they get the connection because it's crystal clear. And so then you start talking about personal responsibility and what can we do to change that. So I kind of have a two-pronged approach to that, where if I'm taking on both groups, but I do get more resistance from the left, which is kind of depressing.
Well, you know, we keep on plugging away, Mickey Z. And so tell my listeners, this has been a great conversation, but, you know, unfortunately we're running out of time. So tell my listeners how they can get more information about your book or how they can order it.
Okay, well, Occupy This Book is available only as an e-book. Sullivan Street Press is a green press, anti-corporate press. So you can purchase it directly from their website as an e-book. So it's Sullivan Street ST period Press. When you go to their website, you'll see an icon for Occupy This Book, and you go from there. I totally respect their approach to non-corporate publishing, and the book may eventually be print on demand, but initially it's an e-book, and I hope that people will take the time to go to Sullivan Street Press and find the book. Or you could just look up Mickey Z-Vegan on Facebook, which I update really, really often in terms of what I'm doing and information about the book, and you get more information there or a better perspective of where I'm coming from. So either approach would get you directly or indirectly to purchase the book. And if you are an activist and you kind of feel in this activist fatigue, perhaps this is the book that's going to give you that little boost to get back into it. Or if you know people in your life that you wish would get more active, perhaps, again, this is the book that can give them reason to question their choices and get out there and join the struggle to try and, you know, change this culture and save the planet.
And it's really, I just find that people think it's overwhelming. All the problems are so huge that they just, and this is the kind of the way I felt before my son was killed. The problems are so huge, I can't really affect what's happening, but you know, any effort we make is positive.
I agree 100%, and I think it's crucial that we maintain that perspective I mentioned earlier, where if something is, if you go to New York City and you want to end the carriage horse industry, that's a fight that can be won. So you get out there and do that while maintaining this global perspective and educating yourself and sharing that info with others. We need to win smaller battles in this struggle, and that gives us, that helps us recruit more people to the struggle, but also gives us the strength and energy to continue day in and day out, because we realize that we can affect change. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether we will live long enough to see the change, but that's, you know, if we want to preserve a future where people can look back with gratitude that we chose this path, that we have to get busy right now.
Absolutely. Mickey Zian, we'll put the links to your book and your Facebook page on our website and in our newsletter. But thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and I hope we get to talk again soon.
And thank you so much for writing the intro to the book. I'm honored and so happy that you're a part of it.
Me too. Thank you, Mickey Z. Our next guest on the Soapbox, I'm delighted to welcome back Gloria LaRiva. Gloria is my friend, and in 1994 and 1998, she was Peace and Freedom Party's candidate for governor of California, a position I find myself in today in 2014. She's the president of the Typographical Sector Media Workers Union, Local 39521, CWA. In 2008, Gloria LaRiva was the presidential candidate of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. LaRiva has been a key organizer of mass demonstrations opposing the Iraq Wars. In 1998, she produced the award-winning video, Genocide by Sanctions. Gloria is coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five and has worked for decades to end U.S. hostility toward Cuba. She has been active in the struggle for immigrant rights, speaking at many mass marches in California. In 1991, she initiated the Farm Workers Emergency Relief Campaign. In September 2005, days after Hurricane Katrina, LaRiva traveled to New Orleans producing the video Heroes, Not Looters. LaRiva was an independent candidate for vice president in 1984, 1988, and 1996. Quite a resume there. Gloria LaRiva, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you for having me on your show.
It's been a long time, but it's great to talk to you again. And the reason I reached out to you this time is because I saw an article you wrote about the situation in Venezuela. And what really upsets me, and I really have to say it upsets me, it frustrates me and angers me, is, you know, even so-called left people in this country spew the propaganda of the empire when it comes to Venezuela. So we know there's some conflict happening right now. And of course, we here in the United States, we are hearing that there's people over there fighting tyranny, and that's what's happening. So Gloria, please tell my listeners and the people of this country what is actually happening in Venezuela.
Great, thank you. Well, I think since Hugo Chavez was elected in 1998 at the end of that year and became president for roughly 14 years, the U.S. began its aggression behind the scenes, sometimes more openly, sometimes, you know, undercover. But the U.S. has been determined to overthrow a revolutionary process that has been in place since 1999 in Venezuela. We have to be very clear about this. This is one more phase of that, the attacks and violence that just was unleashed in the middle of February. And that is largely a result in these last few days of the sharpening of the conflict and more radical economic measures that the presidency of Maduro has undertaken. A few months ago, Nicolas Maduro, who is the new president, was granted an enabling law by the National Assembly. The National Assembly delegates are overwhelmingly pro-socialist. They've been elected by the population on the program of, you know, the Chavez program, the Bolivarian Revolution. An enabling law, which will be in place for 18 months, gives Nicolas Maduro executive powers to pass laws without the need of the National Assembly to draft them. Why is this done? It's in order to be able to take economic measures to protect the population's right, basically, to live, to have food accessible, and things within reason in terms of pricing. The economy is undergoing a lot of challenges and stresses. One of them is inflation. With inflation constantly on the rise, prices of basic essential needs like food, you know, appliances, toilet paper, all the things, you know, soap, all the things that a household needs, they have been going up, and it creates some consternation among the population. Why is this inflation? I think a great reason for it is that since Venezuela is highly dependent on oil for its income, it's a very industrial country that relies mainly on that for income. Most food and other needs are imported. Almost all the food is imported for Venezuela. And the country is undergoing changes to try to increase its food production to become more self-sufficient. So the importers, giant conglomerates within the country, and also foreign companies like Nestle, for example, inside the country, Polar is a great importer of food. What they've been doing ever since Chavez's presidency in 1999 is create false shortages and scarcity by hoarding food, hiding the food, not bringing the food into port to be processed for distribution in the stores. And so this creates and has continued to create at different periods a lot of economic instability.
Right.
At the same time, the revolutionary process has moved ahead. You had a country where health care is, like here, very expensive, inaccessible for the poor and workers. Now health care is free and universal for the population, thanks to Cuban doctors. Hundreds of thousands of houses have been built, bringing people out of shanties, you know, on the hillside that often collapse in rain time. There's been a big increase in people's well-being. Illiteracy was eliminated within a few years, again, thanks to Cuban teachers. And it has also inspired other Latin American countries, the population, the people of, you know, Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, to also elect leftist-leaning presidents because of the example of Venezuela. So basically, a little bit of a long explanation, what's taking place in Venezuela right now is the right wing trying to create disturbances and violence in order to try to overthrow the government.
Well, Gloria, why do you think that, and thank you for that, why do you think that so-called left-wing people here in the United States, and I hate to use that term, but if we divided everybody into left and right, I think these people would be over, you know, the line on the left side. Why do they participate in the demonization of the Bolivarian Revolution? Why are they saying that the right wing is fighting tyranny when in Venezuela, when of course they're just like fighting to overthrow the revolution that has gone just like so far in equalizing income and access to these things that are human rights. Why does the left in this country participate in that demonization?
I think it's a very good question, Cindy. And I believe that the same question could be applied to recent aggressions by the U.S., the European Union, the Security Council of the United Nations, and those Western allies of the U.S. Why has the left collapsed, basically, in refusing to defend countries that are targeted by the U.S., whether it's Syria or Libya?
Uh-huh.
And I think it's largely due to the media manipulation. And the media imperialist corporations, you know, we know all of them, CNN and so on down the line. The things that they've been portraying have been outrageous. For example, with Venezuela, the Minister of Information Communications, her name is Delcy Rodriguez in Venezuela, she held a press conference on Sunday, and she showed quite a number of images that have been distributed throughout the internet, on television in different countries, emanating from Europe and the U.S., some countries in Latin America. And she showed one picture. Remember the young woman who was brutally beaten on the ground by the Egyptian police during the revolutionary uprising?
Right.
And her blouse was pulled off. Remember that one? They were just beating on her. That picture was distributed throughout Spain by ABC, which is a big, big print publication, and said it was Venezuela. They showed also a picture of this young student being choked by a cop who had a whole chokehold on her neck. That was Chile. And so the Ministry of Information is going to take judicial action against them, but the effect is there. I also was at a protest the other day in San Francisco that we held, which is a wonderful protest. There's plenty of people who support Venezuela on the left.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be in the Latino and the Latin American movement, which is much more aware of what's taking place, much more supportive of the progressive, you know, progress in Latin America. And one young woman came up and she said, you know, she wanted to support the action, but she says, I keep seeing all these young people on the media who are, you know, have a band, what do you call it, banding their face so you can't see them, kind of masked things, kind of anarchist looking. And we have to be very frank about this. There's an enormous amount of funding of student organizations, privileged youth in Venezuela. Without a doubt, I think that there is an enormous opposition to the revolution. They are from the upper classes and the middle classes. I've been to Venezuela many times, so have you, and I engage in a lot of conversations with some of these youth, and they are very privileged acting. As an example, Saturday in Washington, D.C., the Anti-Coalition, the FMLN, and other groups had a protest there to defend the embassy against a large crowd of Venezuelans who were demonstrating against the revolution. And they were shouting very racist, very anti-worker things, saying to the black people on the line, why don't you go back to your homeless shelter? They were saying to everybody, come over, we'll pay you double the minimum wage, and who pays you? And Cuban, you know, MS, that is who they are. They were obviously rich, because if you go to any event, you know, the Venezuelan population in the U.S. is overwhelmingly right-wing.
Mm-hmm.
They were the people who had the money to come to the U.S. The poor, very few workers came here. And it's still that way today. So it's a class struggle. You know, the thing about repression is that with the economic measures, by the way, to prevent some of this inflation, in late January, with this enabling law, Nicolas Maduro imposed a law called the Law of Price and Profit Control. Because a lot of these corporations in Venezuela import items and then they jack the prices up, you know, 1,000, up to 5,000%.
Right.
Which is documented, including prices of food. Nicolas Maduro said, starting February 10th, any corporation after February 10th, remember that date, who marks up prices more than 30% profit, By the way, 30% profit is pretty high.
Right,
but
for sure.
Anyone who marks more than 30% profit will be expropriated. And I think that's the reason for this recent explosion by the right wing, the demonstrations, the killings that took place, and the violence that continues today. That happened February 12th, 2 days after the deadline that Nicolas Maduro imposed.
So, Gloria, I get asked this question so many times, but what do you think the chances are of the, we've seen, you know, over a decade of these attacks on the Bolivarian Revolution, and they have not been successful. What do you think the chances are of the success of overthrowing the revolution at this point in Venezuela?
Well, I think what's really worrisome, Cindy, is not a chance of counter-revolution and overthrow of the government, because the majority of people do defend Maduro and the revolution, their revolution.
Right.
Not only that, but they can draw more people in the street. There's more power in the street and in the workplaces of the pro-revolution workers and people than there is of the right wing. The right wing can engage in destructive actions, like they've been busting up metro stations, breaking things, you know. Those kind of actions are easy to do. The problem is not the overthrow within. The problem is what the U.S. has been doing, as we all know too well.
Mm-hmm.
Syria, for example. The majority of people, maybe they have gripes about the government, but they defend the government against the terrorism taking place in Syria. What is the U.S. doing? They're, with the Europeans, they're financing, arming
right.
opposition inside. The U.S. is arming and giving sustenance to the right wing inside the government, inside the country of Venezuela. But the U.S. can do, as they did with Libya, they can create an incident, which they're doing right now. They're creating incidents inside the country to say it's out of control, the violence has to be stopped. I think they're hampered right now with the unity of many countries in Latin America who say, the U.S. stop interfering. But that danger is there. And that's why our obligation, for those of us who understand what's going on, and even if you don't know all the facts, we have to know, we have to oppose all U.S. aggression, actions, interference in the world. It's none of our business, and, you know, the government's business, and the U.S. has to stay out of it. It is to have protests, to have public actions. On March 5, by the way, it's the first anniversary of the very tragic death
yes.
of Hugo Chavez. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a rally at 5 p.m. at 24th and Mission. It's also a day in support of the Cuban Five. Because, you know, Fernando Gonzalez, one of the five, is being released from prison February 27th. So it's a joint action. Both countries are in solidarity with each other, Cuba, Venezuela. But we have to keep having, I think, the protests. Shows such as yours, Cindy, which you've always been on the radical progressive side in understanding the role of the U.S. government in creating much of this distortion and pain and suffering.
I would love to come to the thing on March 5th to honor our comrade Hugo Chavez. So I'm going to put that on my calendar and do everything I can to plan to make it there.
That'd be great. Yeah. Also, you know, I think some of the reason it's difficult for people to know what's going on a lot in Latin America, like if you open up telesurtv.net, that's TelesurTV.net,
mm-hmm.
or you open up Aporrea, which is Aporrea.org, so like on an hourly basis, they have video, news, truth, people on the street speaking. The problem is a lot of people don't speak Spanish.
Right.
And you do, but a lot don't, and it's hard to get the news. Telesur, by the way, which is a great independent anti-imperialist continental station, that was started by Hugo Chavez.
Right.
They have announced that they're going to open a English network, and I hope that will help a lot.
Uh-huh. Yeah, like RT does here. You know, Russia,
right.
Russia Today has the English... to counteract some of the propaganda. But sometimes I feel like they give, you know, more of what's really happening in our own country than our so-called news media does.
Oh, I can't even watch CNN. That stopped a long time ago. I want to say one thing very positive, though. There's a big demonstration taking place today in Caracas, Venezuela. There is a revolution that's moving forward. Two days ago, 40,000 oil workers marched in the streets along with thousands of other people to defend the revolution and say we are defending, you know, the socialist process. And we marched to the rally site to sign a collective labor agreement with President Maduro. That's power.
That is so much.
And remember that in 2002, when the right wing that managed the petroleum industry shut it down and locked out the people, shut down the industry for months.
Right.
The workers didn't have the control that they do now.
Mm-hmm.
That industry is in the hands of the masses. And these are the kind of things we need to look at and see as very positive and strong developments. And the other is that the U.S. Diplomats were kicked out of the country this week. They were watched for 2 months by the intelligence services of Venezuela, and they were trying to recruit youth in the universities who were against the revolution, offering them millions of dollars to start a nationwide opposition network of youth, and they were evicted, the U.S. diplomats. So the country is not afraid to defend itself and so on. And also about the police and the army, you know, the U.S. talks about repression in the country. The police and the army are being greatly transformed. It's not the army, the same army that tried to overthrow Hugo Chavez. They're young people who defend the revolution, you know, who come from the working class and the poor. And the police, to be a police today, you have to go to university.
Wow.
They're educated. And one of the first lessons, the classes they take, are human rights, you know, the charters, international charters, how to make sure you don't mistreat people. I think that there's a lot of great, great things taking place. The state is being transformed into one that's a people's state, a socialist state.
Well, if it wasn't so powerful and inspirational and successful, it wouldn't be under such concerted attack from the global elite.
Exactly.
It's threatening to their way of life, and I just look at it as an inspiration for my gubernatorial run here in California. We just need to get the people to realize how much power they have and what good we can do if we work together.
Exactly. And you know, it's so funny to see the U.S. complaining about what they claim is repression and the arrest. The U.S. arrested 6,000 Occupy protesters.
Right, so disgusting.
You know, thanks to a national FBI local police collaboration to like spy on everybody. We're spied on left and right, we know that. We have our own struggle here at home. And part of that is defending Venezuela. I want to thank you so much. I can't wait to vote for you.
Yay. Well, Gloria, hopefully we'll see each other, and I'm going to try right now to make plans to make it there on March 5th. And you did write an awesome article, so can you tell my listeners the link to that? But I will also link it on my website and my newsletter, of course.
Oh, sure. People can look at pslweb.org or answercoalition.org in the article I wrote, which explains some of the economic changes going on that led to these right-wing protests. It's on there. And, yes, if you can come March 5th to honor Hugo Chavez and the Cuban Five, I think people will be so happy to see you there.
I was supposed to be in L.A., but it's not going to work out, so that works out good for me to be there with you all. So Gloria LaRiva, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and thanks for your continuing work and solidarity, and hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks, and a big hug and kiss to you.
Okay,
bye.
You too. Bye-bye, Gloria. That's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for today. As always, I hope you enjoyed it and were enlightened, informed, and inspired. As always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar, my engineer and our liaison with CPR Metro. I'd like to thank the production assistant for Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank our occasional guest booker, Mikey. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.